This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Here is an excerpt from a recent testimony that was given before the Senate a couple months ago in late June, and I quote, "Congress has given us $22 trillion in debt, the longest war in American history, a broken healthcare system, a broken immigration system, a tax code written by lobbyists, and an explosion of money in politics. Worst of all, too few here in Congress, in the Senate, have the courage to address these problems because the only focus is on re-election." Now, that comes from Nick Tombolides. He's the head of U.S. term limits. He believes that the last best hope for shrinking the size, scope, and spending of government is limiting the amount of time any individual can spend in the House of Representatives or the Senate, kind of like the presidency, which has a two-term term limit. I'm going to talk to him today about the details of U.S. term limits plans and what, if any, evidence supports the idea that term limiting Congress would actually make it more functional, more representative, and more libertarian. So here we go. Nick Tombolides, thanks for talking to Reason.
Great to be on with you, Nick.
So give me the elevator pitch for term limits. How would they function? You know, what are the limits that your group wants to put on Congress, critters? And then, you know, what goals would they achieve?
Sure. Well, the basic premise of term limits, in my opinion, is that when the trash gets old, filthy, smelly, and disgusting, there's really only one thing to do. You've got to take it out. That's what we're aiming to do. Throw the bums out, get a fresh start with people who don't necessarily come to DC to build their own empires. People are frustrated with Congress. 60% of Americans say that they would fire every single member of Congress if they could. Congress has a 14% approval rate at a 98% reelection rate.
It's amazing because for all the talk that we have about how, you know, Trump's approval ratings are historically low for a president this far into his presidency, but he's like triple what Congress is at, right? In terms
exactly.
of approval rating.
Yeah. And it's been that way for like the last five presidents. And it's a sign of a very dysfunctional and broken system. As you noted before, their record has been an absolute disaster. I think they engage in pretty much permanent short-term thinking at the expense of future generations of Americans who will be saddled with this kind of debt, with all these unfunded liabilities.
And I guess if you're a member of the Dingell family, you're not saddled with debt, you're saddled with the promise of a congressional seat sometime over the next 100 years, right?
Yeah, it's like a royal inheritance or something.
A Dingell has occupied the seat of John Dingell, which is now, I guess, Debbie Dingell. His wife is occupying it now, but that's been in the family for like 100 years or something, right?
It has been, yeah. I'm worried. I'm worried when this kind of royal attitude merges with modern technology, and in 50-100 years, we're dealing with like holograms of John Dingell in Congress and Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell. I think that could be the new wave of term limits activism. So, yeah, it's very, very disappointing. They feel like they have a vice grip on this seat. It's an entitlement mentality without question.
And for U.S. term limits, you guys are pushing for what would be the limits? How many times could you serve in Congress and the House of Representatives? How long could you serve in the Senate?
So my personal preference is one term in office, one in prison. Mm-hmm. But failing that, the actual limits we're calling for in our constitutional amendment are 3 terms in the House, so that would be 6 years, mm-hmm. and 2 terms in the Senate. We think that strikes the right balance between getting some degree of experience, giving people time to kind of get their toe in the water without becoming too entrenched, without becoming too complacent, and then turning over so that you get fresh blood throughout the system.
You know, you talked in your Senate testimony, which is up on YouTube at U.S. Term Limits, at the website for your group, as well as your YouTube channel. It's interesting stuff. But you talk about how, like, you know, the minute that you get into office, you're working on re-election. That's particularly true for congressional members of Congress in the House. Is it realistic to say, okay, 3 terms and you're done? Because it seems like in a lot of ways, this is one of the basic arguments, right? That, you know, at the end of 2 or 3 terms, you're barely getting to know where the restroom is, much less having command of legislative process and things like that.
You know, they made that argument to us when we visited Congress. And what we did was we printed up a map of all the bathrooms on Capitol Hill and distributed mm-hmm. that to the congressmen so they would know exactly where it was. I, you know, that's an interesting argument. It's really the experience argument. It does six mm-hmm. years give you enough time to understand the system. But as you noted, there's not a lot of experience in Congress right now, and you don't really accrue more experience as a result of being there. When you get sent to Washington, you have the job of overseeing a massive healthcare system, massive immigration system, you know, the world's most powerful economy. You're regulating taxes and banking and pharmaceuticals. And being a lifetime politician who knows how to smile in a campaign commercial and get reelected doesn't necessarily make you the most qualified person to tackle those problems. And so you don't, the people who come into Congress, in the most part, have no experience, no knowledge of the subjects they're being asked to govern. And what exacerbates it is, as a congressman, you have to be raising money all the time for your reelection. On average, we're told that members of Congress spend 5 hours a day raising money for reelection. They actually get out of their offices on Capitol Hill, walk down to a call center a few blocks down, where they have to sit on the phone like a telemarketer, dialing for dollars, lest they lose their position on a committee or in leadership. The leadership are literally extorting them through this process. So they're not getting the experience they need because they're too focused on reelection. I think that explains why they never read these 1,000-page bills we're always hearing about on the news.
How would only being in office, say, for 3 terms as a congressman or 2 terms as a senator, why would that alleviate the need to constantly be raising money while you're in office?
Well, I think it would change the mentality of the people who run for office. And we can get into this a little bit more when we talk about adverse preselection and who decides to run. But when you come in with the mentality of, it is not legal for me to build an empire in this position. I cannot monopolize this for beyond a certain number of years, whether it's 1 term, 2 terms, 3 terms. When you have a 3-term limit, you may in fact see more members who choose not to serve the full limit because they decide to do something courageous that might be, you know, politically costly or cost them some major contributions, and then they get thrown out after 1 term. But the folks who would run for office under that system have a very different mindset than those who run today under the status quo, because I think those who run today are entirely focused on staying for 20 and 30 years and building as much power as possible.
Yeah, let's talk about adverse preselection. This is something that comes up a lot among term limit proponents. Adverse preselection has to do with what kind of people decide to become candidates or, you know, once they get in office, stay in office. What is adverse preselection and why is it important?
So adverse preselection is a term popularized by Ed Crane, former president of the Cato Institute, to describe a major problem Congress has today, the fact that it's not representative. And that's based on how the system is designed. Americans who've had success in the private sector might like to serve. They might like to help fix the broken system in Washington. But they don't run because they know it won't have an impact. Because you need to put in 15, 20 years at least in Congress to have any sort of clout. That means industrious people who refuse to give up their vocations are not going to run. They don't want to spend that much time in D.C. with so little impact. So the types of people we need to run are not running. Who is running? Folks who happily look forward to a lifetime in politics. And I'll tell you, Nick, those are not the people who are likely to favor limits on government.
When did politicians become kind of professional office holders? You know, is this a 20th century phenomenon? Is it something after World War II? Is it a 19th century, you know, kind of development? What, you know, when did this become the norm?
You know, I think in America, when you look back, it was pretty much a 20th century development. Up until 1900, the average tenure in the House was only, it was between 1 and 2 terms. Mm-hmm. Back then, you know, at the founding era, it was very hard to get quality people to run for these positions because you literally, you know, there was no modern transportation, there was no air conditioning. You literally had to, you know, get on horseback and ride down from Vermont to be a part of the system with very little reward. That's before we ushered in this era of perks and privileges. Politicians became celebrities. You know, it's before the Federal Reserve. It's before the income tax. It's before they realized they could just have a printing press with which they could grant favors to constituents and create this patronage system that keeps them in office forever. So a lot of dynamics have changed, but it was really over the 20th century when you saw the expansion in tenure. You know, part of that has to do with the fact that people are living longer. So I think they just have the capacity to serve longer now than they did in the past. But the real unprecedented growth in tenure happened around the 20th century.
Is there anything distinct in the 21st century? You know, we have heard a lot about since Citizens United was decided that, you know, that, was our Dred Scott decision. I think Keith Olbermann said when it came out, and, you know, it's still a big issue among Democratic candidates running for president. All of them, to some degree, have pledged to get rid of Citizens United. Is there any kind of campaign finance shift that would help the term limits cause or help turnover in Congress more than it is?
You know, I'm not entirely sure. There's a lot of different ways of looking at this. One way I see it, though, is if you are to limit campaign finance, then you are still leaving incumbents with a great deal of non-monetary advantages that they can exploit to stay in office. So, for example, earned media, name recognition, constituent service, creating red tape, helping constituents navigate through it, and then taking credit for solving the problem they created. Franking privilege, where incumbents can send taxpayer-funded mail, campaign-style mailer at taxpayer expense. So incumbents, if you limit campaign finance, particularly if you limit the ability of challengers to raise money to go up against incumbents, I think that could compound the problem of incumbency. Potentially.
And there's really no reason to believe that, I mean, since Citizens United, that people are being reelected at higher levels than they were before, right? Because it was already in the high 80s or high 90s for returns, right?
They are, but I think it's pretty much the same curve that you were seeing throughout the 20th century, just moving upward. There hasn't been any kind of unique change in the rate at which they're getting reelected. It's just getting worse and worse continually.
So let's talk a little bit about kind of empirical results. How many states in the United States or other countries have term limits for members of their legislatures? And what do the results show in that, you know, that we can kind of extrapolate from?
We don't have the complete data on the rest of the world right now. We're actually in the process of compiling that. We're trying to get the most accurate results as possible. I will tell you, executive term limits are a lot more common in different countries than legislative term limits. But here in America, we've got 15 states that have legislative term limits. All of them were adopted by voters from 1990 onward. And those referenda were done with no help from the politicians. Those were done through the petition process, with the exception of Louisiana, where it was added to the ballot because they feared the citizens might introduce a petition otherwise with stronger term limits. So 15 states have it, and the results have been very good. You look at rankings of states based on fiscal health. States with term limits are typically clustered toward the top. I live in Florida, and I think the Mercatus Center we've had 8-year term limits since 1992. I think the Mercatus Center gave Florida its top ranking for fiscal health, 3 out of 4 last years, and now we're still in the top 5. So states with term limits have a higher average ranking in fiscal health than states without it. You've also seen more competitive elections because definitionally what a term limit does is create more open seats. You see more candidates vie for office, and incumbents are not as powerful because they haven't been in office for as long. So it's easier to defeat an incumbent when term limits are present.
That's a big deal, right? The idea of open seats, because when you look at races for Congress in particular, the 435 members of Congress around the country,
yes,
very few seats are open or really contested in any meaningful way.
Exactly. Around 90% of all the elections for Congress are either totally uncontested, meaning you have an incumbent with no opponent, the voters are afforded zero opportunity to vote them out, or under-contested, where the incumbent does have an opponent, but it's, you know, a gadfly who's put his name on the ballot, he's raised maybe $5,000, nobody has ever heard of him, and he doesn't really have a chance. A very small number of races every 2 years are contested, and that is because of the power of incumbency. Conversely, when an incumbent decides to retire, you see tons of competition in these races. You see a dozen candidates vying for it in a primary because now they know it's accessible to them. The barrier to entry has come down. Now you can win that seat with a lot less money. Mm-hmm. You're not trying to pull a sword from a stone by dislodging or dethroning a long-term incumbent. You have a real shot at winning. So it stimulates electoral competition. This is one of the great fallacies of term limits critics is that term limits somehow inhibit voter choice. When you look at the data, term limits increase voter choice by giving us more options than we've ever had before at the ballot box. And that is true across the board wherever term limits have been enacted.
Now, is it fair to say, though, that term limits are not a panacea? You know, and I'm thinking of I lived for a while in California. California has term limits. And what you see there is kind of a weird kind of, I don't know what the right metaphor is, kind of cockroaches scuttling from, you know, one rotting pile of garbage to another. You know, they get voted out of the state assembly, they go to the state senate, they go from the state senate to a locality. I mean, Willie Brown became the mayor of San Francisco after ruling the state legislature there for decades, etc. Is it fair to say that term limit and California itself is a one-party state? The Democrats have a supermajority in the legislature. I don't think a Republican, with the exception of Arnold Schwarzenegger, under very odd circumstances, a Republican has one statewide office since the 90s, it's not necessarily going to make everything kind of rainbows and sunshine, is it?
No, it's not a panacea. It's definitely an improvement over the status quo. California is interesting because in terms of how states with term limits have performed, as you noted, it's an outlier. On average, states with term limits have higher rankings of economic freedom, better fiscal health. You have to remember, it is chiefly an elections reform. It increases turnover, revitalizes elections, reduces the power of incumbency. We've seen that even in California. After California passed term limits, there was a spike in the number of people filing for office. That hasn't abated since they've done it. They have very competitive elections. I think about 97% of all the elections in California are contested, which is way higher than the national average, which is around 65%. So it's reduced the power of incumbency. It got rid of Willie Brown. You're never going to see another Willie Brown again. So it gives voters the opportunity to make positive changes. But it doesn't guarantee the voters will always choose correctly, depending on your perspective. In a state like California, where the voter base is culturally very progressive, very leftist, no term limit will be able to thwart progressive things from happening. But this is all a matter of your political ideology, right? Certainly, Democrats probably don't believe California is a failed state. Tom Steyer is running on term limits because he likes how it worked there. So it really does depend on your perspective.
So one study I read that looked at, it was done by a bunch of political scientists in the early aughts or the mid aughts, and they looked at different states that had enacted term limits. And they concluded that the reform increases the power of the executive branch. And here they were talking about governors and kind of state level bureaucracies over legislative outcomes, and that it weakens the influence of majority party leaders and committee chairs. Is that true? And is that a problem? When we look at Congress, we look at the House of Representatives and the Senate, we've already got a big problem in that the presidency, Congress doesn't really legislate anymore. It doesn't, everything is being done by the executive branch, whether it was under, to a certain degree, Bush, Obama, Trump now, so much power is in the executive branch.
Right.
Do you buy the argument that term limits actually kind of by weakening the power and influence of the legislature actually gives governors or executives more power?
I haven't seen that. And I would advise you to be cautious with a lot of the term limits literature out there because it is literally, in many cases, surveys of state lawmakers and lobbyists asking, hey, guys, what do you think of term limits? Has it worked out? And overwhelmingly, they say, no, it's been awful. Our state is cratering into the ground. Dogs are turning on their owners. People are putting pineapple on pizza. It's horrid. Yeah. And they say that because they have a conflict of interest, because term limits are designed to curb power of these folks. So I'd have to look at the studies and see whether it was done objectively. But I will tell you, at the federal level, we see the opposite of that, right? Over the 20th century, what we've seen is a growth in the federal government from 5% of GDP to 20%. We've seen the federal workforce go from 2,000 civilian employees to 2 million, it's 430 departments, agencies, and sub-agencies at this point. And there's no doubt about this, that there's never been term limits on Congress. So it has been career politicians who have presided over this unprecedented swelling of bureaucracy at the federal level, of giving more power to the executive branch. And frankly, I think it's not a glitch of having an experience that you create bureaucracy. It's a feature of politicians who want to stay in office. Because when you have a great bureaucracy, lobbyists come to the incumbents, they offer them permanent reelection in the form of campaign contributions. The lobbyists extract regulations that are designed to cement their clients' positions or destroy their competitors. And bureaucrats get a lifetime of authority and self-perpetuation to implement those policies. I mean, think about it. Import quotas, ag subsidies, 75,000-page tax code written by lobbyists. Those are examples of bureaucratic overreach coming not from democracy, but from self-interested motives, in my opinion. And term limits sever the relationship that legislators have with lobbyists, sever the relationship with administrators. And I think by pressing the reset button on each one of those districts before the lobbyists can get a beachhead, term limits would create a permanent tension between Congress and the special interests who are trying to buy them. So it would be a very different situation.
So you mentioned Tom Steyer, who's a billionaire, I guess, a Democrat who has talked about running for president. He is a big never Trumper. One of the weird things about kind of the people who support term limits, so you have somebody like Tom Steyer, Barack Obama was in favor of congressional term limits. Donald Trump was very vocal in his support of term limits. What is the level of support kind of among voters or at the grassroots for enacting term limits? And what is being done to kind of try to energize or activate that sensibility?
It is astronomically popular, higher numbers than we've ever seen before. There's a recent poll from McLaughlin and Associates, which showed 82% of Americans overall support term limits. That includes 89% of Republicans, 76% of Democrats, and 83% of voters who identify as independents. So it is not only widely popular, it is very bipartisan. We hear politicians all the time claim they want to reach across the aisle and work on something, work on bipartisan bills, and yet they don't touch term limits with a 10-foot pole because it cuts against their self-interest. It really will take a grassroots effort to overwhelm elected officials with pressure to get them to do the right thing. Of course, in 1995, there was a Supreme Court decision, U.S. Term Limits v. Thornton, which ruled that term limits for Congress may only come about as an amendment to the U.S. Constitution.
That means that a state cannot say, like, you know, Florida can't say, you know what, we are holding our people who go to Washington, we're putting term limits on them. It's got to be done at the national level or not at all.
Yes, that is what we tried in the 1990s. We went into 23 states. We ran ballot initiatives to do exactly that. If you walked into a polling place in Florida in 1992, you voted for an amendment to term limit your state legislature and Florida's delegation for Congress. There were 22 other states that did the same thing. Some of them were amendments to the state constitutions. Some of them were state statutes. In that 1995 decision, the Supreme Court basically struck down all of those state-imposed term limits laws and said it has to be a constitutional amendment because those state laws are trying to meddle with the qualifications clause in Article 1 of the Constitution.
Okay, so then historically, the states have a lot of say over elections, including elections for people going to Congress or to Washington, but that's done. What are the two ways in which the Constitution can be amended to enact term limits?
So the first is what we like to call the chickens voting for Colonel Sanders approach, and that is the two-thirds vote in both chambers of Congress. You know, it's been done 27 times before, but we aren't holding our breath waiting for it to happen on term limits because it's just so unlikely that members would ever vote to curtail their own power. The second way is the Article 5 convention. And this process includes getting two-thirds of state legislatures to say they want an amendment for term limits on Congress. Then all the states come together in a meeting, they draft the amendment. They propose it officially, and it comes back to the states where it would have to be ratified by 38 legislatures. With that method, you are bypassing the swamp entirely. Mm-hmm. You are not giving anyone in Washington, D.C., the ability to veto you. And we think that is way more likely to succeed than the congressional approach. If not succeed outright, it may succeed in painting the writing on the wall and forcing Congress to propose the amendment on their own.
Where are you guys in terms of, like, how many legislatures do you know that you would vote for this, or do you think would vote for it? And is that number shrinking? Is it growing? Whatever.
It's growing every year because we've got a grassroots team. We've got a lobbying team fanned out all over the country working on it. Three states have passed an application for a convention that would strictly be limited to term limits on Congress. 15 states, including those first three, have passed resolutions for a convention that would include term limits for Congress, a balanced budget amendment, and some other fiscally conservative items. So we're well on our way. Politicians all over the country are taking notice of it.
So you've got 15 state legislatures in one way or another pushing for this, but you need
34 to make the initial call for the convention, and then 38 to ratify it into the Constitution later.
What are the states that are best on this topic from your point of view, and which are the ones that are going to be dragged kicking and screaming to the bonfire?
The best ones are the ones that have a track record with term limits, like states where back in the 1990s, USTL or our organization might have run a ballot drive, because the political class in those places knows not to underestimate the power of this issue. They know how powerful it was. They saw people get defeated over this issue previously. And so they're unlikely to stonewall us for very long because they realize the political downside of doing that is very high. On the other hand, the very tough states are, and those are typically Republican-run states, the tougher states are going to be Democratic-leaning states, places like Rhode Island and Massachusetts. Illinois is a real pipe dream, but places that have had long-term Democratic control, multi-decade, no term limits anywhere in the state, and a very entrenched group of leaders within both chambers. Those guys are going to have to be dragged kicking and screaming if we go after them at all. One blessing of this process is you only need 34 states to sign on initially, so you can take the 16 worst states and exclude them if you need to.
How did you get interested in this topic and connected with U.S. term limits? What were you doing before that? I know that you grew up in Connecticut, or you're from Connecticut and went to UConn. You know, how did you end up teaming up with U.S. term limits, and why is this your passion?
So I started out as a pretty typical political activist. I guess you could call me a Republican, if that's still a thing. In college, I worked on campaigns, volunteered, the whole shebang. And after sort of coming of age in the Bush-Obama era, it eventually
How old are you, if you don't mind?
I'm 30. Yeah. It eventually dawned on me, it ain't getting any better. My party is pretty much full of crap. The other guys are full of crap. Third parties are broke. And I'm busting my ass trying to get these people elected. But once they get in, nothing really changes. You know, I felt like I was being scammed, because I was. You had the Tea Party, you had Occupy Wall Street movements with two respective sides. And whether you agree with them or not, they seem to represent a real intellectual debate between more or less government. But most of the politicians who rode those waves, they got elected, they got co-opted, they became part of the machine. So I lost my faith in politicians at some point. It was like finding out Santa Claus isn't real. Well, politicians aren't real either, apparently.
Right. But Santa Claus also has a unlimited ability to tax and regulate you. So it's kind of the worst of all. You're not getting any more presents, but you're footing the bill.
I'm not saying Santa Claus doesn't have the same platform as a lot of modern politicians. And I'm not saying if Santa Claus decided to run for president in 2020, he wouldn't win. I think that's very possible. Going back to this, I was still concerned about things: debt, immigration, privacy rights, endless war, you name it. I felt called to help in some way, help end the racket. And term limits were a natural opening for me, because the foundational premise of term limits is that politicians suck, that they are greedy power mongers, And that appealed to me. So,
and obviously they must be very happy whenever you show up at their door, right? Hey, Mr. Suckage, can we talk a little bit about getting you out of office? I mean, does that make it, does that general temperament make it hard to get in the office?
You know, it does, but that's the unique thing about pushing for the convention. Mm-hmm. I can go into a state legislator's office and say, oh no, it's not term limits for you. It's right. term limits for that other guy. Up in Washington, D.C., you know, he's the real problem. We really need to go after him first. And the incentives are great, Nick, because every state legislator wants to be a congressman someday. So this is like a full employment act.
Yeah, full employment act.
These are job opportunities for state legislators. So I got involved in U.S. term limits campaigns down in Florida, joined a few years ago, and here we are.
Where do you guys get your money from?
It's an angels and activists sort of thing. So we've got
angels and activists are like they're the antithesis of Baptists and bootleggers then, I guess.
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, so we've got a few really big guys who care very deeply about this issue and, you know, write big checks to this organization. And then we've got like the grandmothers and, you know, the people who stick $5 in an envelope and send it to us because they care just as much, but they don't have the same resources. So it really, it's a hodgepodge of different ways.
Are you guys, like, how are you structured? Are you a 501c3 or a 501c4? What is your kind of nonprofit or legal status? Just for those of us who love to talk about the tax code and organizations named after aspects of the tax code.
We're going to get audited after this broadcast, I assume. We have U.S. term limits as a 501c4, but we also have a 501c3, the U.S. Term Limits Foundation, which focuses more on educational efforts in the term limits realm.
And just for so people understand, a 501c3, that's it's an educational or research organization, technically. And that, if people give money to that, you are trying to expose people to the ideas behind term limits, and donations to that are tax deductible. A 501c4 does lobbying, and is it that the donations to that are not necessarily tax deductible, but you can specifically argue for, you know, specific types of legislation or policy change?
Yes, the 501c4 gives us a lot more flexibility in the states as we undertake these very difficult campaigns to get turkeys to vote for Thanksgiving.
Right. So you called yourself a Republicarian, which sounds to me like, you know, kind of a conservatarian or a Republican of libertarian leanings. How do you define yourself politically? And what was the, you know, did you have a Damascus Road experience where you kind of got knocked on your ass? You know, a particular moment where you're just like, my God, what, you know, what have I become?
Yes, absolutely. For me, it was the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. That was my road to Damascus.
Okay, now I have to ask, because I'm older than you, which Iraq war? You mean the one the one that started in 2003?
Isn't it kind of sad that you have to ask? Yeah, because there have been two. It was the more recent one, obviously, the George W. Bush.
The one that is still going on. So explain. So you were a kind of standard conservative Republican then?
In high school, I was. And, you know, after I started to see the results of the war, just the cost in terms of lives, the cost in terms of trillions of dollars, you know, meanwhile, we have places over here falling apart, you know, Detroit, Camden, places like that are falling apart, and we're rebuilding roads and bridges out in Iraq. Started to listen to Ron Paul a lot more. And when he first ran for president, I thought, this guy is a kook. Like, is he insane? You know, I listened to the blowback stuff, and I thought, I'm like, is he blaming us for 9/11? You know, I was so wrapped around the thumb of like the establishment politicians. And then I eventually dawned on me, you know, Ron Paul's been right about everything. When you look at the results in Iraq, he was totally vindicated about that. I mean, that was a disaster. You know, Donald Trump, when Bush was running, I thought to myself, there's no way a Republican who opposes the Iraq war would ever be able to get elected president. And then Donald Trump comes along and tells everyone it was a mistake. And now Republicans tend to agree with that perspective. Yeah, so I really realized that I was sold a bill of goods on Iraq. That definitely ratcheted up my distrust of politicians, distrust of intelligence agencies, distrust of government in general, pushed me in a more libertarian direction. But at the same time, I realized that the gateway to getting any good policy that you favor, whether you're Republican, Democrat, Libertarian, Rastafarian, doesn't matter, is fixing the system, fixing the structure of government. You know, right now we're sort of in a boat and we keep changing the captain over and over again. And it's just not working. We have to fix the boat. We've actually got a hole in our boat. It's leaking. It's going to sink if we don't fix the structure. It doesn't matter who the captain is. And so that's why I gravitated in the direction of term limits.
Now, do you think term limits are inherently libertarian? You know, I guess in a classically liberal sense of that they would minimize or tamp down the amount of power that the legislature or the government would have, and by extension, I guess the executive branch. And if so, is that, you know, does that present a problem? Because, I mean, as much as, you know, I like to believe, and I think there's a good deal of truth to this, that the American people are generally libertarian in that they want a fiscally responsible government. They want a government that is not racking up tons of debt that is going to either inflate the currency or screw over finances or it beggar our children and grandchildren. And they're also socially tolerant. Like, they really don't want the government involved in most parts of their lives. You know, it's one thing to have a kind of state supported safety net. But, you know, beyond that, it's, you know, in certain fairness. But the fact of the matter is that, like, if term limits are kind of inherently libertarian, you know, libertarians don't do that well when they run for office or, you know, kind of go out there. And so I guess the question is, like, are term limits inherently libertarian? And if so, is that a problem for them ever becoming a reality?
That's an interesting question. I do think term limits are inherently libertarian in the sense that they are not a restriction on people. They are, without a question, a restriction on politicians and a restriction on the power of government. I've been in conversations with libertarians before, and they've said, you know, why are you taking away my right to choose my own legislator? Or my own president. I'm like, well, if you could choose your own president, sir, Gary Johnson would be the president right now. It's like, it's tough to get people to understand that elections are not a market. Elections are another big government program. Hmm. If you and I and Ted Cruz walked into 7-Eleven and the two of you wanted Coke and I wanted Sprite, that's what we would get. That's a market. You get what you want. If we walk into a ballot box and the two of you wanted Barack Obama, well, he wouldn't want him. If you guys wanted Donald Trump and I wanted Barack Obama, we would get Donald Trump. An election is the majority imposing its will on the minority. And I don't think that that concept is particularly libertarian. And I don't think elections being an expensive government program are particularly libertarian. And by the way, you look at third parties and their involvement in this whole thing. Do we think that the Libertarian Party and the Green Party just get 1% of the vote in every election because their ideas are so damn horrible and loathed and despised by the American people that only 1% of Americans cast their ballot in that direction? Hell no, man. It's because the system is rigged by the incumbent parties and by the incumbent politicians for their own benefit. Ballot access rules, every other way that the parties do it. The same is true for candidates. The system is rigged by incumbents. It is a corrupt system. And the way to break up that monopoly, the government monopoly, is through term limits. So I think it is inherently very libertarian. I don't think that holds it back in any way in terms of receiving popular support. And the polling pretty much bears that out.
We've mentioned, you know, Tom Steyer, Donald Trump, both in favor of term limits. Barack Obama had been. Two questions. First, is it a problem that Donald Trump is in favor of term limits? Because he's a very unpopular guy. And I know, and I'm sure you know, a ton of people who they don't care whatever he's in favor of, they're against it. But then the flip side of that is among the Democratic candidates right now that are vying for their party's presidential nomination, are there any high-profile people who are in favor of term limits?
I don't know how you define them as high-profile, but we've got—
Let's say anybody other than, you know, the Bill de Blasio, the mayor of New York.
Yes. Obviously, we've got Steyer, who is probably not at the debate stage yet, but— you know, $50 million later, he will be. Mm-hmm. Andrew Yang is probably the most prominent term limits activist among the current field. We met with him a few weeks ago. He's got an interesting platform on it, on his website.
But Beto is kind of for term limits, or?
Beto is very for term limits. Okay. Yes, he was actually the co-chairman of the Congressional Term Limits Caucus when he was in office. He signed the U.S. Term Limits Pledge when he was in office, co-sponsored our amendment. So he is very much a supporter of it. You know, the long-term establishment guys who are running, like the Joe Bidens and Bernie Sanders of the world, of course, are not.
What about Elizabeth Warren? Does she show any interest in this, or?
No, yeah. We actually sent somebody out to one of her campaign events in New Hampshire, and she gave a lengthy explanation about how term limits would empower lobbyists, which is something
that's you're saying she gave a lengthy explanation. I find that hard to believe. That just doesn't ring true. Normally she, you know, talks, you know, one or two sentences. She's like Calvin Coolidge. She never needs a lot of words for anything. But so none of the top three then at this point, Biden, Warren, and Sanders are in favor of term limits.
That's right. Yeah.
So, and does Trump support, and you know, I mean, he talked about a lot of stuff as a candidate. Has he done anything since taking office, you know, that furthers his support or interest in term limits?
I think when he was sworn in, he put out like a YouTube graphic saying term limits would be on the first 100 days agenda. Mm-hmm. So he promised to deliver on term limits in his first 100 days. I think instead he tweeted about it once on like day 465.
All right. Well, maybe he meant the first 100 days of his second term, or when Transportation Week finally wraps up. You know, that'll get to term limits, something like that. You guys have a podcast. Where is the best place to go to listen to that? And what is the podcast about? And I'm going to guess that it's about term limits. But what is it like? How does the conversation change from week to week?
Well, we're on iTunes. It's called No Uncertain Terms, and co-hosted by Phil Blumel, whom you probably know, president of U.S. Term Limits, and myself. And it is a commute-sized podcast we put out every Monday morning on iTunes for those of you who have Apple devices, on Stitcher for folks who are on Android. And it is an update on what's going on in the term limits movement. It is a call to action where we provide people opportunities to get involved in different parts of the country, whether in their states or national call to action, become a volunteer, become a champion for term limits, help make it a reality. And then it's also part like comedy variety show. You know, we've got some funny segments. We recently did the Scammy Awards episode where we gave out awards to the most corrupt politicians in the country. And that was a lot of fun. So
now, who won the Oscar, you know, for best picture equivalent of the scammiest politician?
Mitch McConnell actually took that one home. Yeah.
Okay. Wow. And, you know, I'm sure he's got a closet full of, a trophy room full of things of similar vintage. We're going to leave it there. We have been talking with Nick Tombolides. He's the head of U.S. Term Limits. They have a podcast that comes out every Monday. Check it out. Go to U.S. Term Limits, Google them, and find them on the website. Nick, thanks for talking so much.
Thanks, Nick. Really appreciate it.
This has been the Reason Podcast. I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at Reason, at Google, at Apple, at Spotify, at SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts on. Thanks so much for listening.